This is special coverage from NPR News. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. One state, one Senate race, a couple of governorships, and a clutch of House seats remain to be decided, but the overall picture came clear last night. President Obama won in the swing states and thus in the Electoral College. Democrats expanded their control in the United States Senate. Republicans expanded their hold on the House of Representatives. The coalition Barack Obama assembled 4 years ago proved durable. He won re-election with a majority of women's votes and with lopsided margins among African Americans, Latinos, and young people. The big victories of the president's first term, health care and financial reform, will now be secure. But what he'll be able to achieve in his second 4 years remains open to question. This hour, we focus on what happened yesterday, how it happened, and what it's likely to mean. And we'll begin first with NPR White House correspondent Scott Horsley. He's been covering the Obama campaign for NPR News and joins us now from Chicago on the phone because he's a member of the president's press pool today. Scott, good to have you with us.
Good to be with you, Neil.
And what are you hearing from the president's advisors and from the campaign staffers about, well, there's got to be great satisfaction about what happened yesterday.
Absolutely, but really not a surprise. This played out very much the way the president and his team had projected that it would. They had been expressing confidence all along that he would win at least narrowly in the popular vote and win convincingly in the electoral vote. I think some of us wondered if that was just projecting confidence for the sake of image, but really they obviously knew what they were talking about. David Axelrod had said going into Election Day that we would know this morning who'd been bluffing, and obviously it was not the Obama team.
And to what do they ascribe that convincing victory in the Electoral College?
Well, the president himself has talked a great deal about what we tend to call the ground game, but that, I think, trivializes it a little bit. Ground game, I think, suggests sort of a last-minute get-out-the-vote push. And really what the Obama organization built was a huge network of people that for months and months, in some cases more than a year, had been canvassing neighborhoods, getting to know people, registering voters who had not participated ever before or rarely before, persuading people and also motivating people who had not really been involved in the political process to get involved. That's been a hallmark for Barack Obama dating back to his days as a community organizer in the early 90s in Chicago when he orchestrated a Project Vote effort here in this city that signed up tens of thousands of African Americans as new voters, bringing them into the political process. That's part of it. And then the other part, which is really sort of the Ohio, Michigan, upper Midwest story, is the story of the auto bailout. The auto rescue, which was so controversial back in early 2009 and was never a part of the president's, never something he'd campaigned on, really turned out to be one of the most unequivocally successful initiatives that this administration carried out, and successful both in terms of rescuing the industry, creating a lot of jobs, and also successfully politically in the sense of getting a lot of white working class voters who were not necessarily in the president's camp nationally, but in Ohio, in Michigan, in the upper Midwest, in places where the auto industry is a big employer, they went with him.
In a sense, the campaign focused a lot on we need more time to achieve what we hoped to set out to achieve 4 years ago. If the president claims any mandate for any particular issues, what would those be?
It's going to be interesting. Obviously, the Republicans in Congress never behaved as if the president had a mandate, even in 2008, when he had an even more lopsided victory than he did this time. But I think back to 2010 when the president gave that interview to ABC in which he said, I'd rather be a great one-term president than a mediocre two-term president. And the fact of the matter is there aren't a lot of great one-term presidents. You have to win re-election in order to have the things that you did in your first term survive. And that's certainly true in this case where Governor Romney had vowed explicitly to repeal the health care reform, to whittle down substantially the financial reform. As you said at the open there, those big pushes of the president are now secure. And he, you know, he has talked about other things he'd like to do, including overhauling the tax code, especially the corporate tax code, but perhaps the individual tax code as well. Finally, getting immigration reform, which he hoped to do in his first term, but which he never had any cooperation with congressional Republicans. He's optimistic, as he told the Des Moines Register, that the very lopsided margins that the Democrats won with Latino voters will force Republicans, if for no other reason than political expediency, to rethink their strong opposition to immigration reform and maybe crack open a door to some kind of bipartisan compromise there.
And we noted you're in the press pool today. Any hints you can give us on what the president plans to do today?
You may hear some of my colleagues. We just boarded a bus. We're leaving our hotel to go over to the president's residence where he got to spend the night last night and the night before. And we know that we're coming back to Washington arriving back early evening, but what happens between now and then, we don't know. It's a need-to-know secret, I guess.
I guess we'll stay tuned. Scott Horsley, thanks very much.
My pleasure.
NPR's White House correspondent Scott Horsley covering the Obama campaign, as we just mentioned, on the press pool today. With us here in Studio 3A is NPR national political correspondent Mara Liasson. Mara, thanks very much for coming in after what I'm sure was a long night.
A long night, but a lot shorter than it could have been.
Florida is too close to call still, but the president leads there. He won a squeaker in Virginia. A couple of the other swing states were close, but if you give him Florida, President Obama won every single one of them.
Every single one of the seven battleground states that the candidates had spent all their time and money in. Of the states he won last time, he only gave back North Carolina and Indiana.
And North Carolina was pretty close.
North Carolina was close. Indiana was almost a freakish win in 2008. It was such a strong, traditionally red state. The president really did defy the odds. He defied the odds of history. No one has ever won with unemployment this high since FDR. No one has ever run with unemployment this high. He had just had a rebuke in 2010. The Republicans had swept Congress. That usually sets the table for a win for their party in the next presidential election. That didn't happen. And he defied a lot of predictions that his coalition, his hope and change coalition of young people, Hispanics, African Americans, just wouldn't turn out in great numbers for him this time, not because they weren't for him, but because they were apathetic and because it wasn't the kind of novel, euphoric phenomenon that the 2008 campaign was. But he proved that his campaign can turn those people into what looks like a mature movement, which means you turn out even when it's not so cool and groovy and exciting and hopeful, even when it's a real grinding slog. They use tremendous kind of data mining technology to find their voters, identify them, target them, figure out what it would take to persuade them, having their ads pop up just on the right website where they knew these people were going to be, and they turned them out. And that was the most extraordinary thing, because the Republicans had a different model of the electorate. And as Scott just said, David Axelrod said, well, we have one model, they have another model, and we're going to find out who's bluffing. I don't think the Republicans were necessarily bluffing. They really believed that the electorate wouldn't look so much like 2008 as it did. They thought the white vote would have a larger percentage. In fact, the white vote shrunk. The Hispanic vote and the youth vote grew a tiny bit, I think 1 point or two, and then the black vote stayed the same. And that's just extraordinary.
And as we look ahead to the way the political parties are going to be, well, they're already talking about the next election, but that American populace is going to get the president's part of it, the Democrats' part of it, is going to get bigger. It is going to grow.
Yes. The long-term demographic trends always favored the Democrats' coalition because Latinos are the fastest-growing part of the electorate. And, of course, young people form their habits early. But I think that the Republicans thought they really had one more cycle left under the old rules, you know, with whites being close to 74% of the electorate. Well, they're not anymore. I'm blanking on the number if there were 72 or 3 last night. I know I've said this many times on the air, but I haven't had much sleep.
In the ballpark, yeah.
But they shrunk. They shrunk by 1 or 2 points. And they can't rely on that coalition anymore of older voters, white voters, and especially, as Scott pointed out, that in the Midwest, the president had a way to blunt his problems with white working class voters.
The auto bailout.
I think he has a big thank you note going to Steve Rattner today. But that was very, very important. This election will be picked over by both sides to get lessons. But the Republicans have a lot of soul searching to do. And they have to decide how much of this was Mitt Romney and how much of this was just their whole approach that needs to be changed.
We heard, very broadly speaking, the Democrats would focus on the ground game, which Scott Horsley and you described, that the Republicans, partly because they got started later because of the primary and all of that, would focus on the air war and advertising on television the traditional way, a little bit more sophisticated on their part as well. But nevertheless, it looks like if you were going to pick one campaign over the other, the ground game won.
Yes, but the Obama campaign did focus on the air war, and they had, you could argue, a more effective air war because they knew they had to define Romney on the air in negative ads early, and they just pummeled him all through the spring and early summer. And that really worked because they defined him in the Midwest as an out-of-touch, heartless plutocrat, and his 47% comments gave them a tremendous help in that regard. But I think that by next time, I mean, this always happens. One side has some kind of an innovation, whether it was the 72-hour project that the Republicans used to have to get out their vote at the last couple of days. Now the Democrats have kind of taken community organizing techniques into the stratosphere, you know, really pumped them up. The Republicans will do the same thing. They have 4 years to go out. They have the money. They can go buy a data mining operation. You know, it takes a while to set it up, but they will do that. Now, the question is, is there a big enough pool of voters available to them versus what the Democrats have built? But they'll catch up.
And we're talking about tactics and how the campaign was won. When we come back, we'll talk about what was won and what might be accomplished. And again, we have a divided government now with the Democrats in control of the White House and the United States Senate. Come January 21st, when Barack Obama is sworn in for his second term, we will have a divided government again with Republicans continuing control of the House of Representatives, indeed stepping up their majorities there. Democrats stepping up their majorities in the U.S. Senate as well, but it remains to be seen whether some of those big accomplishments that Barack Obama did get through in his first term, health care reform, fiscal reform, whether those can be accomplished, those kinds of things, in a second term. Stay with us. NPR's national political correspondent Mara Liasson will be here. I'm Neil Conan. You're listening to special coverage from NPR News. This is special coverage from NPR News. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. An election night that many expected to run late wrapped up earlier than many thought it would, at least at the top of the ticket. In the U.S. Senate, a third of the seats were up for re-election. The results in Montana finally came in this morning. Democrat John Tester won re-election over Republican Denny Rehberg. Next door in North Dakota, Democrat Heidi Heitkamp is effectively tied with Republican Rick Berg to replace retiring Democratic Senator Kent Conrad. The tally there, still too close to call. And a couple of tight House races as well. In North Carolina, 7th District incumbent Mike McIntyre, Democrat, virtually tied with Republican challenger David Ruzer. In Florida's 18th District, Republican Alan West is even with challenger Patrick Murphy. Arizona's 1st District, also too close to call between Democrat Ann Kirkpatrick and Republican Jonathan Payton. We'll continue to update those results as the day goes on. Paul Ryan, Mitt Romney's running mate, announced this morning that, given last night's results, he plans to return to the House of Representatives and will stay on as his role in the chairman of the Budget Committee. A number of congressional races, as we mentioned, still too close to call. NPR national political correspondent Mara Liasson is here with us in the studio. Joining us now from Boston is NPR White House correspondent Ari Shapiro, where he's been covering the Romney campaign. Ari, nice to have you with us.
Hi, Neil. Thanks for having me.
And yesterday afternoon, Mitt Romney said he was not going to write a concession speech and focused only on victory. Well, it did not go his way last night, and I guess he had to come up with something at the last minute.
Yeah, it sort of sounded like that, too, honestly. It was a very brief concession speech. It had a few of the themes that have been in his stump speech for a while, bipartisanship coming together, sort of, you know, the thanks to his family and his campaign and to his wife. But it did not have sort of, you know, the arc of a sweeping speech that might have been, you know, worked on for weeks or days.
Has there been any anybody this morning who's, as soon as you have a losing campaign, then you start picking at the bones and saying, here's what cost us, here's how we lost, here's what we might have done differently?
Friends, nobody has come out and said A, B, C, D, E, F, G specifically, but a lot of people are willing to talk on background or speak anonymously, and this is one of those rare moments where people will sort of tell you what they were really thinking all along while they were trying to spin you into believing they thought something else. One senior advisor said, really, if you look at the landscape of this campaign, Mitt Romney, out of the entire campaign, had one really good month where he was clearly surging and ahead of President Obama. That was with the first debate where he performed so solidly. But the rest of the campaign, he was really trailing the entire time. And I think there are many theories of why that is, and all of them are correct. There were structural problems that the Republican Party has to address. There were problems with Mitt Romney, the candidate. There were problems with the advisors that surrounded him. You can dig more deeply into each of those and say, well, if it were different, would he have won? But it doesn't make any of the others go away.
And do we know any idea about what Mr. Romney will do now?
We don't. He's 65 years old, so it seems unlikely that he'll have another presidential run left in him. He hasn't said, and his advisors who I've spoken to today haven't said. Of course, there was kind of a parlor game on the press plane yesterday where people were speculating. It was pure speculation, though. But, you know, he is at the age and at the certainly financial level that if he wanted to just sort of check out and retire, that's absolutely available to him.
And as you look ahead, there was an interesting invitation last night from President Obama to Mr. Romney that he might drop by the White House and talk about his ideas. Any response to that?
It wouldn't surprise me if that happens. We haven't heard a response from the Romney camp. I think today they're all sort of licking their wounds. But, you know, you have to remember through all of this that this was a hard-fought race. But it was also a race in which President Obama expressed a lot of contempt for Mitt Romney, not just as a rival in a race, but on a personal level. There were several moments, you know, in one moment with Rolling Stone magazine, he used a salty term, referring to Mitt Romney essentially as a BSer. And other times during this campaign that you could really see that the president really didn't like Mitt Romney very much at all. So they may well have a meeting, but I don't think we're going to see Barack Obama offering Mitt Romney a position in his cabinet as the Secretary of Business, which was a position the president speculated about creating in a second term.
Mara Liasson, that contempt that the president occasionally expressed for his rival, I think a lot of people look back to that first debate where Mr. Romney started to surge and say, well, there's the reason why the president did not show him the proper respect.
Yes, the president also just wasn't even there. I mean, I think it was not so much the contempt. He showed contempt for him, I thought, in the later debates, much more than in the first one. The first one, he was just extremely passive and let Romney completely dominate. Later, he was sarcastic and snarky, you know, there are these things called nuclear submarines, Governor. But I thought what was striking about his speech last night, and we have to really see if he follows up, is he said, I'm looking forward to sitting down with Governor Romney and discussing his ideas. I don't think I've ever heard a winner say that about the loser, especially, as Ari points out, in this situation where he doesn't seem to like him very much. But he's going to have to follow through on that. He said it. I really wonder, you know, people who run against each other often can patch up their differences. Look at George H.W. Bush and Bill Clinton.
It's interesting. Ari, one of the things that we could see, some things are very visible in a campaign. The two conventions, the Republican convention came first, and you looked at it and said, well, they did okay. The Democratic convention then came just a few days later, and you realized one party knew how to run a convention this year, and one didn't. Then you looked at...
There was one moment in the convention that really stood out to me as indicating a central failing of this campaign, which was that for months and months and months, the Romney camp had been criticizing for failing to really tell the human story of Mitt Romney. And at the convention, we saw this 10-minute biographical video that they had put together that was so humanizing and charming and funny, and it showed sort of the personal side of Mitt Romney that voters had never gotten to see. That video was supposed to air in the key hour when all of the networks tuned into the convention leading up to Mitt Romney's stump speech. But at the last minute, the campaign decided to move it into an earlier hour when no one was watching, and in the hour that everyone watched, instead they put Clint Eastwood talking to an empty chair. So that story to me kind of sums up half a dozen things that went wrong with this campaign, from not defining Romney early on in a proactive way, to making these last-minute decisions that did not well serve the campaign, to putting somebody like Clint Eastwood on the stage when the whole world was tuning in to watch Mitt Romney and really kind of watching somebody belly flop.
And then in the last weeks of the campaign, the Romney camp was, just overwhelmed by the number of campaign offices in places like Ohio.
Yeah, the Republicans often talked about how much better their ground game was than in 2008. And it was much better than it was in 2008. It just wasn't better than the Obama ground game.
Ari, where do you have any indication where the candidate is going to go today? Will we be talking to reporters?
No public schedule announced. I think probably if he were going to do anything public, it would have been announced by now. I just have to say, as somebody who has been traveling with the campaign for the last year and a half, every night we get what's called the FPPO, for planning purposes only, which says exactly where we're going to be and what we're going to be doing every moment of the day. It was very strange to wake up this morning and have no FPPO in my inbox.
Well, Ari, get back to town and we'll get you a few assignments.
Okay, will do.
Ari Shapiro covering the Romney campaign, NPR White House correspondent, with us on the line from Boston. And we apologize for that little technical glitch there in that conversation. But as we look at how it happened, Mara Liasson, we now have to look at what it means. And you look at the president's ideas in this campaign. Well, they're kind of the same ideas that he talked about 4 years ago.
There are. And there are a whole bunch of big problems that await big creative solutions, and he didn't talk about them much on the campaign trail. Now, last night he did start hinting at them, as he did in that off-the-record, then-on-the-record Des Moines Register editorial board interview. He said he wanted to work on tax reform, immigration, and the deficit. And he said and the big problems he wants to tackle are debt and income inequality and global warming. Those are things that will have to be tackled, especially the deficit, a fiscal cliff coming right up, and immigration. I think that's on the front burner. I think the real question about elections are, it's a big mistake to say that an election means nothing. You know, for the Republicans to say, well, it's the status quo ante. We're back to exactly where we started. it's also a mistake for the winner to assume that they've got a big, huge mandate. I think misinterpreting your mandate is the most common problem among winners. And this is still a closely divided country. The president did win narrowly in the popular vote, even though he got a landslide in the Electoral College vote. And it will be really interesting to see how he approaches the Republicans in negotiations over the deficit, how he decides to use the power of the presidency. You know, he was faulted by a lot of his supporters for being too weak, not really making the case for his proposals, couldn't seem to ever make a deal with the Republicans, who, of course, were being obstructionist. But there are two sides now in this divided government, and they are going to have to come together on some of these issues. I don't think we can kick the can down the road too many more months or years.
And that is the first can lining up to be presenting itself is the so-called fiscal cliff. This was the deal that Congress worked out the last time they raised the debt ceiling, which said, well, by the end of the year, if we don't make a deal on deficit reduction, there's going to be across-the-board cuts in everything, and the Bush tax cuts will go away.
The fiscal cliff is a result of the failure of Congress to come to a deal. They said, as you put it, you know, if Congress can't do something permanent and solve these problems, well, we're going to punish ourselves, or we're going to have an automatic solution that everybody hates, and we hope it will motivate us to come together. Well, it hasn't yet. But there are two parts to this. One is the fiscal cliff, which is the expiration of the Bush tax cuts and the automatic spending cuts that will be across the board. But then there's the bigger deal that has to be made on entitlements and tax reform, and you have to figure out how you're going to do those two things. You could have a temporary solution that gets you past the fiscal cliff, put in place some broad principles or goals for the bigger tax reform, entitlement reform, and then work on those over the course of a year. You can't do tax reform in a month. Or, as some Democrats have suggested as a tactic and a strategy, let's go off the fiscal cliff. You know, Republicans have held a gun to our head too many times. They were willing to risk the full faith and credit of the United States with the debt ceiling. Let's just say, okay, you know, if you don't want to come to an agreement with us, we'll let these tax cuts expire, which means taxes will go up for everyone. Mm-hmm. And voila, the deficit will really be helped. It will be shrunk. We'll maybe take a huge hit to the economy in the process.
Everybody says a recession.
Everybody says a recession. And then we can start from there. You want to put back in tax cuts or tax reforms? We can talk. Because if nothing happens, the Bush tax cuts go away. Now, it's at a cost to the economy, but the president is now a lame duck. And so this is going to be another one of these high-stakes poker games in Washington. But there are plenty of people working on this. The Bowles-Simpson Commission laid out a kind of roadmap to how you get to an agreement. There's a group of bipartisan senators in the Senate working on something that would be a negotiation where Bowles-Simpson would be the fallback plan. Bowles-Simpson would be the automatic sequester if they couldn't come to another kind of deal.
The default.
The default, yes. So we'll see what happens this time. I have to believe that this whole year and this campaign has taught Barack Obama some things, and he's a different kind of president. He alluded to that last night.
One of the things, though, he did say consistently through the campaign is that there have to be a bigger share paid by those who earn the most money.
Yes, a bigger share. That doesn't mean you have to raise their rates. This is something that if you listen closely to Mitt Romney in the debates, he would say, I don't want to cut taxes on the wealthy. What he said is, I don't want them to pay any smaller share of total tax revenues. So you can do a lot of creative things. And I think that one of the biggest contributions that Bowles and Simpson made is they offered this vision of tax reform, which is shorthand for lowering rates but broadening the base, in other words, getting rid of loopholes and deductions, so you actually can bring in more revenue while people's marginal rates are lowered. And a lot of conservatives only care about marginal rates. They don't care about whether they end up paying more or less in taxes. They want the certainty of knowing what they're paying on the last dollar that they make. So that's a big contribution, and I think that one of the things the president was faulted for is he never grabbed it and ran with it. Now he has another chance.
And this will have to be addressed, the fiscal cliff issue, in the lame duck session.
Yes, but the lame duck session is the same. It's almost the same as the new Congress coming up. So that's maybe a benefit.
The new Congress, though, we're just hearing from the Senate Majority Leader, Harry Reid, the Democrat from Nevada. Well, one of the first issues they're going to have to face is increasing the debt ceiling again. He said today that the debt ceiling increase likely to be considered after January 1st. Well, that effectively means after January 21st when the new Congress steps in.
It's like Groundhog Day. We're back to the same thing. And I think the question now that the players have really not changed, we know, you know, in terms of their numbers and their relative levels of power, have they learned anything? Are they willing to approach these problems differently? The president didn't get a lot more troops on his side. He gets to say, I told everyone that I wanted to have the rich pay more, so therefore I'm elected, and that's a kind of a mandate. But this is I think the American people will really demand that Congress do something else other than just fight each other to a draw.
We've been talking about the president's relations with the Republicans in Congress. What about his relations with the Democrats in Congress? Barack Obama did not do a lot to help. The Democrats picked up seats in the Senate, but he did not do a lot to help them. He did not do a lot of campaigning for anybody in the House, and then the Democrats lost seats in the House.
That's true. But the Democrats in the House are the least powerful players in this whole mix. As far as the Senate, what he has to worry about is, yes, there are some new liberal kind of heroes who were elected. You know, Elizabeth Warren is a new liberal member. But the centrist group of Democrats, a lot of them who are up in 2014, people like Max Baucus and Mary Landrieu, and who knows about Angus King, who's the new
independent, we assume
he's going to caucus with the Democrats.
He's going to tell us next week.
Yeah, I think those people will exercise a certain amount of leverage because they're the ones who are up next time. They're the ones who are running in red states, and they need a balanced deal. The president said all along, I want a balanced deal. I want spending cuts and tax cuts, tax revenue raises. I want more in spending cuts than in tax hikes. You know, he would use the ratio 2.5 to 1.
Right. A dollar in new revenue for every $2.50
right,
in cuts.
Right. And we know that the Republican candidates in the primary, when offered a deal of 10 spending cuts to $1 of tax hikes, said absolutely not. Now, we'll see if that changes. There are plenty of Republicans who acknowledge you have to have more revenues. That's different than raising people's tax rates.
Now, as we look ahead at these conundra stepping up one after another, and they are lined up, as you say, one after the other. So we know what these agendas are going to be for the next several weeks. And then the first item of business, we also have to talk about what's going to be new in the Obama administration. Secretary of State Clinton says she will leave as soon as a successor has been chosen. You get turnover. There is also the issue that was mentioned prominently in this campaign. The next president, and we now know that's Barack Obama, will likely get to appoint one or two new members of the Supreme Court.
Yes, but we don't know if those members would be the kind of openings that would change the balance of power on the court. I mean, if he's just so far, the openings he's gotten have been to replace one liberal or liberal-leaning justice with another. And so the question is, would he get the kind of opening that changes the balance of power on the court?
So if Ruth Bader Ginsburg, yes, to pick a name, steps down, he's likely to get his choice through.
Yes, yes.
A bigger battle if Antonin Scalia, yes, steps,
yes,
down.
Yes, and I can't imagine any of the conservative justices, if they have some breath left in them, won't want to wait for 4 years.
As you look ahead to the next 4 years, how quickly are people going to start focusing on the congressional races 2 years from now?
I think pretty quickly, but I think we are in a period of stability in the House because they made their majority in a redistricting year, and that's pretty significant. If you get your majority right before you're going to draw new district lines because of the every 10-year census, you get to provide your members with a lot of protection. And I think that that played a role in keeping their majority in this election. I also think the tremendous amount of financial advantage they had. The money race was more or less even on the presidential level. On the congressional level, it really helped Republicans. There are something like 30-odd Republican House members who spent less on their own re-election campaigns than the super PACs did on their behalf.
NPR national political correspondent Mara Liasson. When we get back, we're going to go back to the swing states. Well, there's one still undecided, Florida. Yes, Florida. Stay with us. I'm Neil Conan. You're listening to special coverage from NPR News. This is special coverage from NPR News. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. The president's coalition turned out for him last night. Women, Latinos, African Americans all came out to vote in big numbers, particularly in the swing states, relatively close in Virginia, Colorado, Wisconsin, Ohio, and some other states. President Obama clings to a half percentage point lead in Florida. If he ultimately picks up that state, it would be a clean sweep of blue across the swing states on the electoral map. We're talking about today about how that came together, who voted where and why. Here in studio, NPR national political correspondent Mara Liasson, but let's go straight to Florida. In the end, President Obama did not need Florida's 29 electoral votes to win re-election, but that tight race there came as a surprise to some. Sergio Bustos is state and politics editor for the Miami Herald and joins us now from studios of member station WLRN in Miami. Nice to be with you today.
Good afternoon, Neil.
Also with us is Tamara Keith, a congressional correspondent for NPR. She spent Election Day in Ohio, and she joins us from Columbus. Tamara, nice to have you back.
I'm glad to be back.
Sergio, ballots are still being counted in Miami. What's the latest?
About 20,000 absentee ballots are being counted, but we are thanking the political gods and above for the fact that Florida doesn't matter at this point and that it's a done deal nationally.
So how long is it going to take before somebody certifies a result?
Unclear. I guess legally it'll take a few days, but right now I think hopefully today will be it. There were about 9 counties when I left the newsroom last night at 3 a.m. that had not completed its count, but it looks like it's coming down to just Miami-Dade with its absentees.
And Miami-Dade absentees, you would expect those to, if history is any guide, break for the Democrats.
Yeah, South Florida is largely Democrat, a huge number, about 32% of all of registered Democratic voters in Florida are in Miami-Dade, Broward, and Palm Beach counties.
Coming up to Election Day, a lot of people, I think, including the Romney campaign, thought Florida would end up being a red state. What do you think made the difference?
You know, it's very interesting because I too thought, and our polling had suggested, that Romney could win it here in a squeaker or by a good margin even. You know, the exit polls show that the economy was at the top of the list. 62% said it was the most important issue, followed by health care, which was all the way down to, I think it was 17%. So I thought clearly that was the issue. Jobs are still, the unemployment rate is still higher here than the national rate. And we've got a foreclosure crisis that kind of was ignored, I believe, during the campaign by both Obama and Romney.
So they did not ignore the state of Florida, however. They when they weren't in Ohio, they were in Florida.
And they were in our television sets, on our radio, on our websites. It was a tsunami of political ads in Florida.
And as you look back at the campaign, what do you think is the lesson that each party is going to derive from what happened yesterday?
I don't know. Maybe it's the too much money might not do it, but I think you still have to talk voter to voter. And I think that's where the Obama campaign deserves some credit. Their ground game and their organization was pretty good. And I was amazed, and I would salute the voter today in Florida, especially down here. I talked to voters on Saturday night, the last day of early voting. At 7 o'clock at night, they were 500 deep, and they were determined to vote. I had a guy, I told one guy, listen, mail me when you get out. And he emailed me that he had been in line from 7 to 10:30, but he had voted, and he was very happy.
And voting, that took some time, depending on which county you were, but some of those ballots that were two sides, six pages long.
Yeah, I equate it to going to a history class in high school, suddenly realizing, oh, my God, this is on the test? Oh, I'll just skip this, or I'll just fail it and I'll try to get the next one. It was an incredibly long ballot, and it took precinct workers a long time to process. And I think that explained, in part, the long lines.
And it explained in part why the results were trickling in all night long, because I think people were just a little overwhelmed by the amount of paper.
Oh, no doubt. I mean, it was like somebody equated it to reading like a small phone book, and that's probably not too far off.
Let's go to Ohio and Tamara Keith. As you looked at the results there, one thing the presidential campaign of Barack Obama points to was the auto bailout and how much difference that made in the industrial state of Ohio. Tamara?
Overwhelmingly.
Go ahead. We hear you now. Go ahead.
Yeah, absolutely. So looking at the exit polling that we've seen, voters here in Ohio overwhelmingly supported the auto bailout. And of course, that was something that Governor Romney had opposed. And so that was clearly an important factor. Another thing that is, I think, interesting in the exit polling data is that it really looks like the Obama campaign did a very good job of doing what it wanted to do in defining Governor Romney as not identifying with the average person. President Obama dominated in that category. And another thing that is remarkable is that most people made up their minds before September. And that's really when Governor Romney started trying to define himself here in Ohio.
Interesting. Also, as you look at the demographics of the state of Ohio, you might think if you're a Republican, this is a place we should win.
Absolutely. I mean, there is a large white population, a large white evangelical population, and those are populations of people that the Republicans do quite well with. But President Obama was able to sort of build a coalition of everyone else. One thing that you look to is what was he able to carry forward from 4 years ago? And one county that was a county that everyone was sort of looking at is Hamilton County in the Cincinnati area. And President Obama was able to continue to carry that county, even though there are some heavily Republican suburbs in that area.
Mara, I wanted to ask you about as you look at the fact checkers, neither campaign was distinguished by its devotion to total accuracy. But Mr. Romney was on the defensive on the car, on the auto bailout from the beginning. And then the ad that he was running here in Ohio in the last month about the Jeep and GM car jobs being sent overseas, that just seemed to get him in even deeper.
Yeah, it's interesting. He had this by now infamous or famous op-ed piece saying, let Detroit go bankrupt. And the Obama campaign pummeled him on that for months and months and months. He was encouraged by Rob Portman, the senator from Ohio, to step up and explain his position and really fight back. And what they chose to do was make an ad that erroneously suggested that Jeep was moving its production to China. It turns out Jeep is going to make Jeeps in China, just like most car companies like to make them near where their customers are. But they were actually adding jobs to their assembly lines in Ohio. So that was widely covered, and it was called, you know, a false ad, and I think that really hurt him. What's interesting is that they used the exact same tactic on another problem they had, which was Medicare, and it worked a little better for them. Instead of defending Paul Ryan's plan to turn Medicare into a voucher system or a premium support system, the way they did that is they ran a lot of ads saying, oh, the president's cutting money from Medicare. So they kind of fuzzed up the issue, confused it, and said the president's cutting $716 billion from Medicare and I'll put it back. You know, that worked for them in Florida because Medicare did not hurt them as much as it could have. He still did pretty well with seniors. But I think that, you know, in the auto bailout, it really hurt. They had a lot of problems that they had to correct, and everything you do in a campaign is under a magnifying glass. And even though what was extraordinary about this campaign was that Romney was able to do the Etch-a-Sketch, he was able to almost erase his previous image as a heartless plutocrat after the first debate and come off as a pretty decent, reasonable, moderate guy, you can't erase everything.
And Tamara Keith, it's interesting, Sergio Bustos was telling us the unemployment rate in Florida above the national average. Of course, he was also referring to the disastrous real estate problems in the state of Florida. In Ohio, the economy is doing rather better than the national average.
Absolutely. Basically, the economy here, the unemployment rate here started turning around in very early 2010 and has been improving ever since. The unemployment rate here in Ohio is currently 7%, about a point lower than the national average. And in part, that's because of how well the auto industry has been doing. There are a few auto plants here, but more significantly, there's a huge number of auto suppliers here. And those suppliers have been adding jobs for years now. One interesting other little factoid from the exit polling, and I find it completely fascinating, is that even among people who had someone in their household lose their job over the last 4 years, President Obama had a slight edge, very slight, but even among people who had lost a job. So I think that's a sign that, for whatever reason, Governor Romney's economic message didn't quite resonate as well here as in other places. And in part, that could simply be because the economy is actually better here.
And it's the Republicans will take some credit for that, too. The Republican governor, John Kasich, in Columbus will say this is the Kasich-Obama recovery, not just the Obama recovery. But in any case, the future of the industrial Midwest, as you look across the electoral map yesterday, with the exception of Indiana, and that is that's not insignificant, but with the exception of Indiana, this was Democratic country all across the industrial Midwest.
Absolutely. It's one of those things that maybe you didn't expect or wouldn't have expected. And clearly in some of these places, the margins are quite narrow, including here in Ohio.
Mara?
You know, what's so interesting looking at this map, I mean, the big question this year was Ohio going to start performing like a typical Great Lakes Democratic, you know, blue-leaning state? And it doesn't mean you don't have to fight for them, but it's possible that Ohio becomes like Wisconsin, Michigan, Pennsylvania. I mean, it's just, you know, a Democratic-leaning state. And when you look at this map, I mean, the Republicans are going to have to do some real head-scratching. Where do they go? There used to be a Republican lock on the Electoral College. For years, Democrats bemoaned the fact that they couldn't win. Now it looks like it's tilting in the other direction. All those states we thought Romney was ahead by a hair, Colorado, Florida, Virginia, you know, he couldn't get them. And, you know, it shows you that the electorate is changing, but also where voters are. They're located in a lot more advantageous places for Democrats right now.
Including New Mexico, which now looks like a solidly blue state.
Yes, and then, of course, the Democrats have their eyes on Arizona, where the Hispanic population is growing by leaps and bounds. Georgia, where the Hispanic population is growing. And they think, not next cycle, maybe not the cycle after that, but in 25 years, Texas, you know, is going to be a place they think they could be competitive. This is why the Republicans are going to have to do immigration reform.
Sergio Bustos, we were talking about Ohio looking like other states. Florida looks like Florida.
Yes, Florida always looks like Florida, and then a couple years later, it looks like Florida again.
This is
that's all I can say.
This is a state that has been given all the demographic changes in the state, nevertheless remains just absolutely 50-50.
Yeah, it's an extremely bizarre state in the sense that it's the legislature is dominated by Republicans, has a Republican governor, but then every 4 years. We start going through absentee ballots and having these whiskery close elections.
At least you don't have dangling chads this time, or at least not that I know of.
No, I was brushing up on provisional ballots, and now I can put that book away.
What story will you be writing for tomorrow?
It's a line that President Obama said late last night, early this morning, I should say, after he thanked the voters. He mentioned, thank you for the people who stood in long lines. We're going to fix that. And we thought he was talking directly to South Florida. And the big question for us is, how are we going to get these lines to be more reasonable? People shouldn't be waiting till 5-6 hours to vote in a presidential election.
And on the other hand, people might say, didn't Florida get its wake-up call about changing all this a few years ago?
Yeah, I'm sure the wake-up call came, but, this is another year, and I think we hit the snooze button.
Sergio Bustos, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
Sergio Bustos, state and politics editor for the Miami Herald, with us from the studios of our member station in Miami, WLRN. Tamara Keith, let me turn back to you. As you look ahead, what story are you going to be filing for tomorrow?
Well, I may not actually have anything on tomorrow, but I'm looking forward to the fiscal cliff. I think the congressional hat comes back on, and it's all about the fiscal cliff and what happens next, and whether the mandate that Speaker John Boehner says he has and the mandate that President Obama now has from his reelection, whether those mandates are able to come together and find compromise, or whether we're headed to a giant clash in the next month and a half.
You were talking about that southwest corner of Ohio down in Hamilton County. That, of course, is where President Obama scored an important victory yesterday, but that's also Speaker Boehner's country.
That is Speaker Boehner's country, and in some ways, it's sort of surprising that President Obama was able to hang on to that territory, but he did, and it will be very interesting to see how those two men work together in the coming months, or don't work together, as the case may be.
As the case may be. Also, Rob Portman, who came to prominence during this campaign as the President Obama's stand-in in the preparations for the debates for Mitt Romney, the senator from Ohio from the Republican side. Of course, Sherrod Brown, the Democrat, won re-election yesterday. But Rob Portman, I think, is going to be taking on a bigger role in the party as well.
Absolutely. And another person who's going to be involved in these discussions about how to solve the nation's fiscal challenges is vice presidential candidate Paul Ryan. So I think the same cast of characters are going to be part of this production going forward.
Tamara Keith, thanks very much.
Thank you.
NPR congressional correspondent Tamara Keith with us from Columbus, Ohio, where she spent Election Day in what again proved to be a vital swing state. And Mara Liasson, as you look ahead to that Congress, as you look ahead to the new players on the scene, certainly Paul Ryan, an important character as the chairman of the Budget Committee, but nevertheless, he takes on a much greater mantle.
I mean, Paul Ryan is going to be one of the most closely watched characters. He's the intellectual leader of the House of Representatives, as we heard over and over again. He is the author of their budget that has passed now twice in slightly different versions. He is widely expected to run for president in 2016. So what does that mean? Does he have to make is it important if he makes a deal with the president? Does he lead the kind of Tea Party Republicans against the president? I mean, I'm not sure what his calculations are. I think it's really hard to lay the foundation for a presidential bid from the House of Representatives, especially when you are in effect a leader in the House. Now, the fiscal cliff negotiations could be over by the midterms. He could leave, start laying the groundwork outside of Congress. But everybody's going to be paying attention to every move this guy makes.
Especially if he decides to travel overseas. That was a deficit in his resume, as he proved in the debate with Vice President Biden. And it's interesting. We've gone almost the whole hour. I think that was the first time we uttered the phrase Tea Party.
Well, the Tea Party was a big factor this year, and we didn't really talk about them, but they once again, you know, ruined Mitch McConnell's day. And
the Republican leader
in
the Senate.
Yes, and this has happened before. They definitely helped Boehner because the Tea Party faction in the House is still strong. A couple prominent members like Alan West, you know, were defeated.
Yeah.
May lose. He still is outstanding. Yeah. Okay. But the Tea Party is important, but the Republicans have the same problem, which is they're a Tea Party big source of their energy, can't win without them. They are the grassroots of the party. But what do they do when they nominate candidates that can't win Senate races?
Maybe he lost 6 Senate seats over the past 2 election cycles. Mara Liasson, thanks very much for coming in. I know after a very long night. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
NPR national political correspondent Mara Liasson with us here in Studio 3A. You're listening to Special Coverage, The Day After. I'm Neil Conan, NPR News in Washington.